Okay. Yeah, now it works. So I think it's something because I started from it saved a file after the crash or just before the crash, and then I restarted with that file, and I think that may have been may have caused the problem. Okay, anyway, we're good to go now. So we are importing complex main because at some point we want to argue about logarithms in running times further down, so that's why we're not using just main, but the theory, the base theory that also contains the real and complex numbers. And there is already a predefined version of insertion sort in the library, and we don't want to reuse that. We want to define our own, and that's why we're hiding that name to just avoid these ultra-long names. And this is something that is frequently useful if you have lets in your in your expressions. Most of the time you want to expand them automatically, and this is what this command is telling you, telling the system to do. So here are the two main functions: insort, which takes a single element and a list and inserts that element at the right place, assuming that the list is already sorted. And so it just goes through the list. And if the list is empty, well, it will just insert it then and there. And if it has a head y and a tail y, then it'll compare x with y. And if it's less than, then that's the right place. And we're finished. And we just return the list x, y, and y's. And otherwise, the first element of the head of the list becomes the first element, and we insert in the rest of the list. So a very traditional recursive algorithm, going down the list, finding the right place to insert the element. And isort is the actual insertion sort, and here the key line is, of course, this one, where you first recursively sort the tail of the list, and then you insert at the right place the head of the list using the previous function that we just defined. Questions about that? Right. Then let's go and prove functional correctness. And unsurprisingly, this won't be very difficult, I will take you through some of the proofs anyway. The first one is really easy, that the multiset of elements in the insort function that inserts an element is the same as the multiset of elements in your input, and then you add just one element to it. And that will be, as we've often seen it, if you have hierarchy of functions, then you need some basic correctness you need some correctness properties for the base layer of the functions, and then you work your way up. And of course, here it looks like magic that that I'm coming up with this lemma, but in reality, you want to prove the top-level theorem, and then you find you need some lemmas. And here we're just presenting the lemmas in a bottom-up manner. And then the insertion, that the full insertion sort works correctly, that it returns the same multiset of elements, that's again another induction. So everything is very simple here because insertion sort is just a primitive recursive function on the data structure of lists, and so everything works by straightforward induction on lists. And here, of course, we need, for the induction step, we need the lemma that we proved above this one. And now I've deleted part of the input, and we can try and figure out what was missing here. So we want now. So this is the end of it. We know that the multiset specification is satisfied. How about the sorted? So this is what we're going to prove, that I sort, the insertion sort algorithm sorts correctly, produces a sorted list. And the since this is I sort is by recursion on the list and it's just primitive recursion, we just do an induction on the list and we get two cases as usual. And then auto can solve the first one, but it can't solve the second one. So first question, what lemma should we be proving here to help us prove the induction step? Yep. Right. So this there's already some room for variations here. So the way it was phrased here is if the list X is sorted, then insort of X and X is also sorted. And I think this will work. So let's just do it. It may also show some problems. Let's just see what happens. So these proofs are all quite simple because the functions are simple, so we don't need to write either proofs. Apply style will do. So we do an induction on axis, and we do auto, and see what is left over. And there is quite a bit left over. Well, this is what's left over. And now the question is, how can we continue here? What else do we need? And that's not so clear, but you can look at certain subterms and think, oh, maybe those subterms should be simplified. So not everything is as simple as you would wish it to be. Of course, it's as simple as it can be given the lemmas that we have. So in this case, you don't need to look at the big picture. In fact, one of the assumptions needs to be simplified further. Okay, then I'll focus your mind. This is something that should be simplified further. But we don't have a lemma for it yet, so. Yeah.
It should be XA is a set of X as union X and we don't have element because we want to prove that for one sets.
Yeah, that's precisely the right answer. So this is something we rejected as a specification, but we need it now in the proof. Why do we need it? Because the sorted predicate doesn't talk about multisets. The sorted predicate says the head of the list must be less or equal all the elements in the set of the remainder of the list. And that's where the set comes from, but as you correctly pointed out, we've only proved it for multisets. But it should be a trivial consequence for the sets. It is a trivial consequence, as we shall see, but we haven't stated it. And so we first need to state that. And it's let's just look at what we need. It's for the set of... Oops, where are we? Here. set of insort. That's what we need. So let's write this lemma down. And there is an insert function on sets as well, which I tried to avoid simply because we will have lots of insert functions on other data structures like trees. And so often there is a clash, and then you need to prefix the names with the theory names. So I prefer here in the lecture course to just write things like this. But I could have written insert x axis. So let's see if this helps us any. Let's just give that a name. And let's not prove it yet. And let's add it here in our proof that didn't quite work out. Simp, what was it? Set insert. Yeah. Yep, so that did it. And now we can prove this one. Now, since it's so close to the multiset version, maybe Sledgehammer can prove it automatically. Now that doesn't look very good. Yeah, I think this is not going ahead. But really, it should follow from the multiset version. So what you can do, if you think that there is some lemma in there that should be quite helpful, you can say using, and then you explicitly say, please use this lemma here, mset insort, because that's practically the same lemma, but on the multiset level instead of the set level. And maybe that will help Sledgehammer. Maybe Sledgehammer didn't really pick up that one. Let's try again if we give it explicitly there. And then you apply Sledgehammer after you've stated the using, and now it suddenly says proof found. So sometimes, I mean, Sledgehammer isn't perfect. Sometimes what's happened probably here is it didn't think this lemma was relevant and didn't try and use it, and therefore it didn't find a proof. So here is one. Yeah, why don't we use that one? So we don't need this using anymore. We can just mset insort. We can just add this to the lemma list in here. And then it's all in one line. And just for curiosity, we can look at the different lemmas that I use. So this is really the key lemma that we needed from the multiset level. And then what we have, insert is union. Ah, yes. So here it is actually using a lemma that converts our union version of writing this into the insert function that is primitive in the system. And then what else do we have here? Set, mset, add, mset. So here is a lemma that converts between the insert on the set level and the add multiset on the multiset level. And we would never know about this if we didn't have Sledgehammer that picks out these lemmas. And finally, there's the set, mset, mset. So this is probably, again, some conversion. Ah, yes. So this is the function that takes you from a multiset to a set. And if you apply that to the multiset, from a list, then you can directly apply it to the list itself. So these are just trivial little simplification conversion lemmas, and we didn't really need to know about them. Stetsamer found out about them, and the only one that we needed was this one. Of course, you could also prove the lemma explicitly by induction. That would work just as well. But it seems like a kind of overkill to start an induction if it's a simple consequence of what we already have. And now we have this lemma. So that we've now finished proving that insort preserves sortedness. So let's call it sorted insort. And we can now use that to actually finish our proof that the isort, the insertion sort algorithm, is always, the result is always sorted. And yes, that works. Just a little a hint, or not a hint, just a discussion. This is the most natural way to state it, but it may not be the best way, in the sense that maybe there's actually if and only if, that the output is sorted if and only if the input is sorted, so something stronger. So you could try and make this an equality, an if and only if. Oops. Whatever. Where are we? I think I've lost it, so now it is. Yeah. So we could make this inequality, which is always nicer to have, because if it's an implication, it'll try to use it and say, okay, I'm trying to simplify this, but first I have to simplify this. And if it fails, you just don't get anything. Here, if you can use this lemma, then every time you see this pattern, it'll directly be replaced by this one, making your formula simpler. And indeed, I just changed the text and the same proof still works. So that's something worth thinking about. If you state your properties, can you make them equations? Then they're just more convenient for the rest of the proof. But the other one is, of course, perfectly fine, too. Any more questions about this whole proof of insertion sort correctness? Then let's switch back to the slides. And let's think about time, running time. And the principle that we will use is we simply count function calls. So this is a very abstract way of talking about running time, but it's a standard way of doing this. And what we will do is we will, by hand, for every function whose running time we want to determine, we will define a timing function which has almost the same type, except that the return type has changed into a natural number, so that running time function returns the number of steps that the original function takes to compute those. If you give it those inputs, how long does it take to run them? And the translation is, so it's important here, this TF is basically just a simplified version of F. It's not already a closed form solution for the running time. It'll be a recursive function that looks in its structure very much like the original F, and you will then have to solve it and have to show that this recursive definition of the running time is something that can be expressed with polynomials or logarithms or whatever. And so what we do is we translate really quite naively from the function f into the function tf. So we take a function definition for f and translate it to a function definition for t of f that looks similar. On the level of equations, if you have a defining equation for function f, you turn it into a similar defining equation for the function tf, so the patterns on the left-hand side stay the same, and on the right-hand side, well, here you have some expression e, and up here in this inference rule tells you, well, if expression e can be translated to expression e prime, then this function definition can be translated to this function definition, where here we have the expression e prime plus 1, and the plus 1 is just the function call that we're counting. So we're saying, how long does it take to evaluate this recursive call, this function call? Well, it takes as long as it takes to evaluate the expression e, which is e prime, plus 1 for the function call of f. And so this squiggly arrow, the leads to arrow, that's just a relation symbol that here it relates an equation to another equation, here it relates an expression to another expression. So this starts the translation process. This is the more interesting bit where the expressions are translated. But you can see the definition is almost the same, except that here it's a definition on the type, on the return type tau, here it's a definition on natural numbers. And how do we translate expressions? This, what I'll show you is a bottom-up translation. So if you have an expression like this that starts with a function call of some function g, and g has k arguments, how long does it take to evaluate that? Well, here is the expression in terms of natural numbers, the number of steps that it takes to compute this expression. And how do you get it? Well, first you have to compute how long does it take to evaluate S1 to Sk. That's this translation. So you translate the expression S1 into its time and the expression Sk into its time. And then you just sum up how long does it take to evaluate this, the time it takes to evaluate all the sub-expressions S1 to Sk, plus the time it takes to run G on those arguments S1 to Sk. So it's really a translation of an expression into another expression. We're not evaluating anything here or trying to solve a recursion equation or anything. We're just translating from the original function definition into the running time function. And we're translating here, we're on the level of expressions, we're translating expressions into each other. And then, so this tells you if you have a compound expression that starts with a function call, what if you have a variable? How long does it take to evaluate a variable? Well, here we just make the very simplifying assumptions that variables and constants that don't have any arguments, they just take time 0 to evaluate. You could also say they take time 1 to evaluate. It's just that I want to keep things as simple as possible. So here I'm taking 0. Why is that okay? Well, we will always have this plus 1 for every function call. So all the other basic constants in there, it's okay to assume that they're 0, because you can never get just a recursive function that doesn't cost anything. That's the worry. If you take 0 here, maybe you end up with a function that takes 0 time. That would be strange. But you can never do that, because you always have this plus 1 here for the call of the function itself. So that's a very informal justification of why this is an okay choice. If you want to be more precise, then you can take 1 here and get rid of the 1 later on in a moment. And what about constructor calls? Because this function, the timing functions, they only exist for the defined functions, the functions that you have defined yourself or that are predefined in the system. But the constructor functions like cons or nil, they are not defined anywhere. They're just primitive. And so here we assume that they cost 1. The primitive operations of type bool also assume cost 1. This is a bit inconsistent, I think, but you have to think about that carefully. Maybe we could have got away with 0 here as well. I'm not quite sure. Here we're being a bit more faithful. And The fact that primitive operations on bool cost one, that makes a lot of sense because they're typically realized by a single instruction. And constructor calls, they cost one because it's not a single instruction, but it's typically, it is constant time. You just need to allocate a little bit of space on the heap and then move a few pointers, and that's about it. So constructors cost very little. Here's an example of how to actually perform this translation. So this is a function, the append function on lists. This is the base case, and this is how it's translated. So this defining equation for the append function is translated into this defining equation for the time the append function takes. And here I'm writing 0 plus 1. Where does the 0 come from? The 0 comes from the access to the variable. I've assumed access to the variable costs nothing, and so that's the 0. And the plus 1 is just for the fact that you've called a function. That's where the 1 comes from. So this is the 1 at the very end of the translation here, the plus 1 in the translation of the function f into the timing function for f. This is the recursive call. So how much does that cost? Well, let's look at it. This is the claim that I make. I claim, according to our scheme on the previous slide, this function definition translates into this function definition. So yes, this must be the time it takes to evaluate all the terms on the right-hand side, plus 1 for the recursive function call. So how do we get all of these numbers? We have 1, 2, 3 variable accesses, so that's 1, 2, 3 zeros. We have one constructor call that was counted as 1, so probably it's this one. And we have one recursive function call, so this is the tapp of the two arguments, x's and y's. So that's this here, or in fact this whole parenthesized expression here, is just the result that we saw here, where we have a function call with some arguments. First we determine how long it takes to evaluate the arguments. The arguments are variables, so we get 0 and 0 here, and then we add up the zeros, and then we get the call to the timing function on those arguments that the original function had. So that's exactly where this part here comes from. So that's the translation of the time it takes to evaluate this expression. Questions? Yeah?
So it's like the proper one?
The previous slide?
Yeah. If we have a function g that takes a parameter that it never uses, why do we have a cost for it? Because we never have to evaluate it.
Well, a very good question. So what we're actually assuming here, and that comes in one or two slides, is a call by value semantics. Yeah. So in a call by need or lazy evaluation semantics, as in Haskell, this would be overestimating. But it wouldn't be wrong because we're always claiming these are upper bounds later on. But it's one of the key questions you have to ask here. What is really the model of computation that you are assuming? What is the cost function based on? And indeed, it's a call by value model. And now you can, instead of these recursive rules, you can also have a more compact formulation of this translation of an expression into a time. You just say the time it takes to evaluate the expression E is just the sum of all the times it takes to evaluate all the sub-expressions. So you go through all the subterms of E, and for every subterm of this form, you just say, well, we need that time to evaluate that sub-expression, and so we just look at all the sub-expressions and sum up over the times. So that's a nicely simple, a global view of it. The other one was more where we really go through the recursive structure of the expressions. Here we just look at the expression as basically a large tree, and we look at all the subtrees and sum up the times for all the subtrees. And then with the special case, if you have a subterm of your original term E, where G is a constructor or a predefined function on bool or numbers, then it should be 1. And I think I'm being inconsistent here because, let me go back. Oh no, I don't say on bool and numbers. Yes, so I'm consistent. So I'm assuming that computations on numbers and booleans cost a single time unit. And this, of course, isn't completely justified because in languages like Haskell or ML, you have arbitrary length integers. And so if you're working with really big integers, then the time to perform some even primitive operation like addition will not be constant. But again, that's something we're sweeping under the carpet. So this isn't a completely faithful model. If you're really dealing with huge numbers, then you're underestimating the cost. If you just say the cost is 1, you should really use something like the logarithm of the number itself, but then it gets ugly. Now we have ignored one thing, namely if and case, and they indeed play a special role, and even in a call-by-value language, case expressions or if expressions are evaluated lazily. That means the condition is evaluated only depending on that value, either of the two branches of the then and the else, or one of the branches of the case will be evaluated. So to model that faithfully, and we want to model that faithfully, otherwise we get far too large upper bounds. This will be the rule how to treat an if then else. So how much does it cost to evaluate that? Well, certainly the cost it takes to evaluate B, so this is the translation that translates B into its cost, plus, well, then depending on the value of B, either the cost of T1 or the cost of T2, where up here we have assumed we have already translated S1 into its cost and S2 into its cost. Make sense? Then, well, for case, it's just similar, except that we don't know. I mean, there might be arbitrarily many branches, so it's more difficult to write this down, and I'm just sticking with the if-then-else. Now, we don't really want the precise number of steps, and so we will allow ourselves to simplify our time terms, and to simplify them so that we get the same order of magnitude, but not the exact same constants. And so, essentially, we are happy if we reduce all the additive constants to 1. So here is an example. This was our original, this was not. This is what we derived for the recursive equation for the timing of append. And here you see it's actually, this of course all disappears and this sums up to 2. But essentially, it's enough to just say, oh, this is 1 time unit, because if something is 1 or 2 time units, if you're just interested in the O off, it doesn't make any difference. It's the same it's the same order of magnitude. It's O of 1. And so that's why for our simplified approach, it's actually quite enough to write it like this and convert the 2 that we would have gotten to a 1. Now, so that essentially what you get is you get these something like this, TF of some argument, call it P equals, and then you get lots of sums of T, G of something or other, where the G is some function that's called on the right-hand side of the defining equation. and then it's another t, g prime, something, and then in the end you get all these constants for evaluating constructor terms or accessing a variable or have some primitive numeric computation. So then it will be some constant c here, which is, well, basically 1 plus 1 plus 1, however many primitive operations you still have in there. And we are saying, all we're saying here is that just approximate this by 1, otherwise it makes your life more complicated. So we could, in principle, automate these definitions of the timing function from the function f, but you could even prove the correctness of this definition from some semantics that you may have in mind. This all just gets too complicated, and if you look into any algorithms textbook, they never bother to do that precisely. They just have the same informal approach that we have here, how to estimate the time for a piece of code from the code itself. And we're just laying down some very simple rules here to get something that's approximately okay. So O of should be okay. And now let's really go to the, I think I've managed to leave my notes behind. Yeah, that's a bit unfortunate because I do want to, I wanted to demonstrate this on the board. So give me 3 minutes and I'll be back with my notes. So let's first look at the definitions of the timing functions, at least one example. Here is the time for the insort function. Up there on the top part, you can still see the I've reproduced the definition of insort, and down the t-insort, you can see the definition of the timing function. So the base case is clear. That's just a 1 for the call of the function, and everything else up here, well, we've set variables cost 0, constructor calls cost 1. This, the singleton function, the singleton list, is essentially 2 constructor calls, 1 for the empty list and 1 for the cons function. And so that makes 2, but we have reduced everything down to the constant 1, so we just leave here, we just leave the 1 here. And where does this come from? Sorry about this. Of course, the corresponding line above. And strictly speaking, this is already quite simplified. What you may have come up with is the following, which is more, follows the structure of the whole thing a bit more. You would, if you look at the top line, the for insort, then you would think the time for insort of x and y y's should be equal to, now it should be a plus 1, and it should be an if then else, because that's just the top of operator on the insort definition is the if then else, and the plus 1 for the function call. So it should be if x is less or equal y. Then you should initially have said, okay, how much does the x, y, y's cost? Nothing for the variable x's, but 2 for the 2 constructor calls. And else, else we have the second part, the else branch here. So how much does that cost? Variable access costs nothing. Insort, well, that's just the time it takes for insort on, x and y's. Plus the cons time here, which is 1. Plus 1. So this is what would have come out of the, if you follow the rules faithfully for how to compute the timing. And then I've just said, well, this plus 1, I might just as well. Here the plus 1 and the 2, they just, you can collapse them to 0. Why? Because you have a plus 1 anyway here. So that's the reasoning to make things simpler. So this is the O of time of this one, and the one where I said, no, here 0, justified by the plus 1 here, and here we don't need the plus 1. That's all down to the plus 1 there. And maybe one could streamline the rules a bit more to give us directly the second expression. I'm doing it in two stages, where first you get a complicated expression, and then you say, okay, all the additive constants can be reduced to 1, and so that leaves us with that one. And let's try and do the same thing here for isort. What would the what is the first, according to the rules, what is the complexity of evaluating this expression? How would you express that down here? So here we have the just textually reproduced the two defining equations for isort, and here I'm defining the timing function that gives us back a natural number, and it's clear that in the first case it's 1 just for the function call, and the plus 1 for the nil constructor is again merged into the 1, and we retain 1. So the question is, how much time does this one take here? Just informally first. I mean, it's a small formula. It's not just 1 or 2. Yes.
The time of insert in it plus the time of isort plus 1.
Yep, exactly. So it's t of insert x and isort of x's. So the outermost function is the timing function, but inside you still have to produce the right arguments, and so you still have to call isort plus the time it takes to call isort plus 1 for the function call. And I think this is the right definition. And right, so now let's just think about the running times. So we have these two functions, isort and insort. Let's start with the dot bottom one. How much time does it take to insert a list, an element into a list? And it will be sufficient to have an upper bound, so we're always interested in upper bounds here. So can you give me a simple upper bound? Now I'm really asking you for a solution of this recursion equation, but it's not too hard. The length of the list, indeed. Plus 1, it turns out. So I'm using the abbreviation to save myself from writing long identifiers. Why is it plus 1? Because even if the list is empty, you still need 1 time unit for the call to the function. Okay, so that's that. Now, the next one is t of isort of x's. And here, you should know from any algorithms lecture that insertion sort takes quadratic time. So in fact, at this point, you'll be thankful that you have reduced all the constants down to 1, because otherwise you get these really nasty expressions with 37 and 42 and whatnot in it. So here it really works. It's the length of x's plus 1 squared. And let's just look at how to derive that really quite precisely. So that'll be our focus. And here we are. The proof is, since the timing function has the same recursion pattern as the original function, it's just recursion on lists, so it would be an induction on lists. And let's look at the induction step. So in Isabel's case, Collins x axis. So we already know that it works for x's, and now we want to show that it works for cons x x's. So start out with T of I sort of x cons x's. Okay, we could just use the definition.
What is it?
That's the time for the recursive I sort plus the time for insort applied to x and I sort of x's plus one. And we can immediately use the induction hypothesis and replace the time for I sort by, well, exactly what our induction hypothesis tells us. So this is using the induction hypothesis of t length of x's plus 1 squared plus the remainder, which I'm not going to copy down again, by induction hypothesis. And the question is, how do we continue? In the end, we want to get, at some point, we want to get less or equal length of the one longer list, so x hash x's plus 1 squared. So this is our aim, and we still, well, we have something that's already going in the right direction, but we also have the second term here that isn't yet of the right form. You don't have to be precise about it. What should we be using or doing at this point? Yeah.
Assuming we already proved the timing for the insert method, we can replace the second term.
Yes. So this is the first lemma that we haven't proved on the board, but it's simple enough. We use that lemma to give us a less than or equal for the for this term I sort of x's. So we will be using here, and I'll write it down. We will be using an instance of that first lemma. T insort of x and I sort of x's is less or equal length of x's plus 1. Wrong. Less or equal length of I sort of x's. So that's great. That gives us an upper bound for this second term, but what do we do about this part? This is length of I sort.
It does not change.
Yes. So we just need another lemma that I sort doesn't change the length. So I will just on the fly use that lemma that's actually equal to length of x's plus 1.
So this is another little lemma that I'm not even bothering to write down. And so now we have it. This is, let's recall this term plus length of axis plus one. And if you do a little bit of high school arithmetic, it turns out that this is really less or equal to this one. You just need to multiply out the square, and it's less than or equal. Yep.
Don't we also need to define for the second isor call? Or why can't we just on the
here we have it.
No, but for the isor call x.
Yes.
Yeah, so the second call should also.
But see, this is a call of isor. This is no time call.
No, yeah.
So this is just needed to get the right to compute the right argument. But it's important to keep these two things apart.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? In that case, that completes insertion sort, and let's go over to a more interesting sorting algorithm, namely merge sort. This, I think that should be the end of insertion sort. Yes. And now I'll step up the tempo a little bit. After all, I do assume that you have been through a basic algorithms course and merge sort. So first, a top-down version of merge sort. That's the standard version and that's usually taught. And how does it work? It is based on a function merge that takes two lists and merges them, assuming the lists are ordered, and always takes the smaller element from one of the two lists and puts it into the output, and then recursively merges the rest list. So if one of the two lists is empty, then you just get the other list, and if they're both non-empty, so both have a head and a tail, well, then you compare the heads and pull out the smaller head, in this case it's x, and then you merge the remaining lists. So a very standard recursive function. And then merge sort is just defined on top of that. What does it do? So merge sort for an arbitrary list axis, first let's abbreviate n stands for the length of axis. And if the length is less or equal 1, well then the list is sorted. You just return the list. And if there are at least two elements, then what you do is you merge the two lists that you get, namely the first n div two elements and the second n div two elements. Well, that's not quite correct. So you take here n div two elements from the input axis and you recursively merge sort them. You drop the first n div two elements, so you take the rest, and you recursively sort the rest. And then you merge the two sorted lists. So I do hope that kind of algorithm that you've seen before. So what we will now do, again in accordance with the literature, we will not determine the precise running time, but we will just count the number of comparisons. That makes things simpler. And that's another reason why we haven't automated this translation from a function to its timing function, because frequently we say, oh, we don't actually count everything, we just count certain things, and then you have to do it by hand anyway, you have to set up the definition by hand. And so I'm not going to show you these definitions, they're in the file and they are what you would expect them. So C merge is the number of comparisons that you need in order to merge two lists, and CM sort is the number of comparison to merge sort a single list. And just to make sure that your intuition is right, what is an upper bound for the number of comparisons when you merge two lists, x's and y's?
Length
of a longer length of the lower list?
No. It's easy to get this wrong. I got it wrong. I mean, there's a very simple upper bound, but of course the question is why doesn't yours work as well? Because I always also thought it should be the length of the longer one, but no, not necessarily, because you might. Now it seems it should work. No. Say you have two long lists, and then you alternately take one element from one and then one from the other, because that's the way they are ordered, and then you must traverse both of them. Yeah. But this one, I think, is in no doubt that this will work. It might appear that it's a bit over generous, but I don't think it is. I think in the worst case, this is what you can get, that you really need the length. And this is the time for merge sort that you have seen, I hope, in algorithms lecture, except that there it's usually phrased differently. So what I'm saying here is if your list happens to be a power of two, so I'm just looking at a specific example to make things simpler, then the cost for merge sorting that list is just k times 2 to the k. Well, if you rewrite that, then of course, since if the length is a power of k, you can also write here, this is log, so this is the length times the logarithm of the length, and that's exactly the formulation that you're usually familiar with, n times log n. And here the n happens to be a power of 2, and therefore this is the n, and this is the logarithm of n, the binary logarithm. And you could do it without this assumption here, but then you typically, in the proof, you need a floor or ceiling functions, and I just want to abstract from these more algebraic numeric complications and get down to the bottom of it. So I think, I'm not sure I really wanted to say much more about this one. I don't think so, because the proof is really quite standard. There's not much to say about it, and in some sense it's similar to the one that we saw for insertion sort. Of course, you need this upper bound, and then you can compute based on that with an induction. Now, of course, it's not an induction on the length of the list, but it could be on the length of the list, but it's not a structural induction, because merge sort doesn't recurse by structure, but it recurses by reducing the length. So, yeah, let's not look at that one. Let's instead look at the bottom-up merge sort, which is something that works quite well in a functional setting. And so what is the idea? We have a merge sort bottom-up that takes a list into a list, and it works like this. First, we treat the special case of the empty input list separately, and then this is the main idea. If it's a non-empty list, what you do is you map every element in that list to a single list, and then you repeatedly merge those lists. So it's like you start out with a lot of single lists, and then in the first iteration through the list, you merge all adjacent single lists into lists of length 2, and then you do another iteration and merge them into lists of length 4, and so on, until you've just ended up with a single list. And so it's bottom-up, because you start with the small lists and merge them to larger ones, whereas the previous one, you start with a large list and cut it up into smaller ones. So we need the merge all function that goes through a list of lists and merges adjacent lists. So it takes a list of lists, returns a list, and we have treated the special case here separately, the empty list, so we can just leave it undefined. And if it's a singleton list, well, then there's nothing more to do, nothing more to merge. You have only one list in this list of lists, and then that is the list that you return. But in all other cases, if you have at least two lists there, then first you call merge adjacent. So you, that's basically one pass through that whole list of lists that merges all the adjacent ones, and then you call merge all again. So this is like a loop where you repeatedly pass over the list, merging in each phase, in each pass over list, you merge the adjacent one, and then you repeat the loop to see if there are any, if there are more than two lists left. And this is where the actual work is performed, in the merge adjacent. And yeah, it takes the list of lists and merges adjacent ones. And so if there's nothing to merge, well, that's it. If there's just single lists, there's nothing to merge. And if there are at least two lists, then you merge those. So the first two lists get merged into a new list. And then you recursively merge the adjacent ones in the rest of the list. So you still have a list of lists, but of half the length than the previous one, because you've always merged two adjacent lists. Questions about that algorithm?
Can't it be expressed by only one function, mismatch or mismatch adjacent? Why do we need to separate it?
Let's first clear up something else, then let me come back to your question. This definition is the one that's used in Isabel 2018, but it's a little bit too complicated. I wasn't thinking when I wrote that down. We can drop, make this first line here, if you merge all of the empty list, you get the empty list, and then you don't need this special casing here. Imagine that this first equation, you've dropped the if then else, and you just say merge bottom up is the same as merge all of this, and then here instead of undefined, it's the empty list. So that's just it simplifies matters a little bit. Now we come back to your question. You want to do it all in one function. Maybe that's possible. I haven't thought about it. What would that function do? How would you define it?
Actually, the first two cases, both cases, are pretty simple. So I think in merge all, it can be replaced. Or just directly call merge adjacent in the first merge and sort.
I'm afraid I didn't quite get that suggestion. So.
Is it possible to call a merge adjacent instead of merge all in the first?
Here?
Yeah.
But then that will just merge one level of lists. So it will just, if you have 20 lists out of this map, then merge adjacent will give you 10 lists. But you need to do this repeatedly. So maybe with some clever way of organizing the code, it can be done. Do send me the, if you come up with a good solution, do send it to me and I will notify everybody. But I would rather press on with the, So I'm not saying it can't be done, I'm just saying I don't see it and let's do it offline. So then we get these three comparison functions. How many comparison functions are needed in merge adjacent, how many in merge all, and how many in the complete function, bottom-up merge sort. And this is the theorem that we want to get out at the end. If you have, again, a list of length at the power of 2, then this complexity should again be the length of the list times the logarithm of the length of the list. So I don't think I really want to walk you through the code. Let's just look at what we expect, what theorems we expect to hold. So I'm not going to give you the proof of that one, but let's just think about what we would expect for the two other functions. So let's start with the merge adjacent. And we want the number of comparisons of merge adjacent of some list of lists. And we want an upper bound. And we also want to make use of this assumption that what we arrived at started from a list of length of power of 2. So what does that mean? How can we translate that into this situation? Yep. Or in fact, the power of 2 is irrelevant. But what is relevant, if we want to get a simple, if we want to look at a simple situation, what can we assume at this point for the length of all the lists in there? Yeah? They're all of the same length, because you start out with a power of 2 of lists of length 1, and then you merge in one phase, you get lists of length 2, and so on. So here we don't need that it's a power of 2, but we need, in order to get a simple expression, we need that they're all the same length. So for all x's element set of XSS, we have that the length of X's is some m, some constant m. So that's supposed to imply that. And now suggest an upper bound here for the time for merge adjacent. It'll be quite simple, so it's not, no plus ones needed. And of course, it uses the function merge, and we know that the function merge is bounded by the time for merge is bounded by the sum of the length of the two lists. Yeah?
It's 2 times n times the length of XSS.
2 times n times. Right? Almost right.
Divided by
2. Divided by 2, which means we can drop the 2. So, yeah. So the 2 comes from the fact that when you merge, you add the same length twice, but you only merge half of them. So, and then from that we can derive a second. Oh, where is it? Here we are. We can derive the merge all, and I'll just write, because that will have a lot of assumptions. And we again assume the same assumption as before. So all of that is our first assumption. They all have the same length. Our second assumption will be again, will indeed, now you will need to know that it's a power of 2. And if you have these two assumptions that all of them, all of the lists in there have length m, and there are 2 to the k lists, so then this is not an equality here, this is a lesser equal. Any suggestions for it? Actually, we knew what it's there. No, it's not there. Sorry, I mean merge all. Yeah. So, any suggestions? So this is a function that really takes a list of lists and merges them repeatedly until you arrive at a single list. That's maybe not so obvious anymore. So I can maybe start you off with something. You should be able to infer it now because the merge bottom up is a special case of merge all. If you look at the definition of here we have merge bottom up is a special case of merge all where you start with singleton lists of length 1. So if this is the theorem we are looking for, how does it follow? How should it follow from this theorem? What value of m do we use? M is the length of all the lists here. So for merge bottom up,
it's just 1.
M is just 1. So this is 1 times k times something. In the end should be k times 2 to the k, so the real solution is this one. And it's not completely trivial because you're summing up first the first pass of merge all sums up, merges all the lists, merges basically all the lists and half the list and a quarter of the list, so it's a non-trivial sum. And this is the right expression, but it takes a bit of time and space to actually prove that, and I'm not going to go through the proof, but by reverse engineering what you want to get at, this is how I arrived at it as well. But I had to think about this intermediate result for a bit before I came up with it. And I think that's the end of today's lecture and the end of sorting. But let me just conclude with one little remark, namely, one can do even better. So this, what I'm going to tell you about now, I'm not going to verify anything, is the standard merge sort algorithm in the Haskell library, and it is a bottom-up merge sort, but it's better than the one that we have seen. Anybody has an idea how you can improve on the one that we have seen? And you can improve on it in practical situations. And what happens in practice typically, if you want to sort some list, what often happens?
You have sublists that are not already sorted.
Yes, and so you take this sorting algorithm takes advantage of this. Here's an example. If you want to sort this list, you don't need to start off with lists that are all of length 1, but instead this is the naive way of doing it. You start with all the singleton lists and then start merging them, but it's better to say, oh, this is a decreasing sequence, 7, 3, 1, so let's make that into one list, and this is an increasing sequence, 2, 5, and let's make that into the other list, and that works out fairly well if you recursively walk over the list, and then you just need, in fact, one merge step to get the right answer. So that's just the last little trick how to improve the bottom-up merge sort. And with that, I really want to close for today. Thank you.